This is a recording of the talk titled Signs of a Nation by leading legal academic Carwin Jones at Te Pātakatoi Adam Art Gallery on the 4th of March 2026. This talk was the first in a four-part series, Kōrero Pono Mai, Talks on Te Tiriti and the Treaty, that ran in conjunction with the exhibition Whai Wahi. We joined the recording with co-curator Brooke Poe, introducing Jones and the series co-papa.
Okay. Tēnā koutou katoa. Thank you for joining us at the Adam on this beautiful day. My name is Brooke Poe. I co-curated this exhibition with Abby Kinnane. I'm just here to give a brief intro before Carwin begins. This exhibition, Whai Wahi, emerges as a contribution to contemporary discourse around te tiriti or waitangi and ideas extending from this. Anchoring the exhibition is the treaty panel from Te Papa, just around the corner. Brought into the gallery, the panel continues its work of calling for accurate representations of te tiriti or waitangi. This lunchtime lecture series, Kōrero Pono Mai, runs alongside the exhibition all throughout March. These talks take heed from Te Waka Hodua, who call upon institutions to kōrero pono mai, tell the truth. Kicking off the lecture series today is Carwin Jones, who is kaihautū of Te Whare Whakatupu Mātauranga at the Wānanga in Rokawa, lead academic in the Māori Laws Program. His research focuses on te tiriti and the rights of Indigenous peoples. Today, Carwin will speak on how the ways in which institutions like Te Papa present te tiriti help to shape our understanding collectively.
Tēnā koutou. Ngā mihi nui ki a koutou, e hui hui mai nei tēnei ahi ahi. Tēnā tātou. So, thank you, Brooke, for the introduction and the invitation to come and speak with you here. I was really keen to accept that invitation because I think the one of the things that the panel from Te Papa and the work that Te Waka Hauroa undertook really demonstrates is the importance of art, action, in continuing the conversations about our understanding of te tiriti. And so it's nice to be in amongst these artworks here today. And I'm also really pleased to be part of the series of conversations, lunchtime conversations that are going to be held here. I note that usually in a whai kōrero kind of situation, I've been told that for the first speaker, the most important thing to do is to leave things for the following speakers to say. So I'll do that. And I'm sure they'll pick up on lots of interesting kōrero and conversation. Okay. One of the things that I wanted to talk with you about today was to really think about the point that the stories that we tell are really important in terms of our constitution. Now, that might sound like a bit of a leap for some people, but one of the things that I've come to think more and more about working in spaces of law, te tiriti, and the constitution is to recognize that constitutional spaces are not only governed by law, but they're very much determined by the legitimacy that comes from a people, from a society, and a society's commitment to give power to those constitutional foundations. So legal developments can change the landscape and help to support that, of course, but they're never disconnected from the broader public discussion and conversation. And I don't think that's especially true in the context of thinking about te tiriti or waitangi and understanding that the constitutional impact of te tiriti is very much dependent on the legitimacy and the power that we give to it. Just wanted to start by talking a little bit about what a constitution is, first of all, to put this in a bit of context. So in the Matika Mai Aotearoa report, the way in which government and constitutions are defined is that it says government is the process that people choose to regulate their affairs, and a constitution may be understood as the code they use to describe how government will function. A constitution is also the kaupapa, or set of rules that a community sets about who can make the rules and how the people should abide by them and live amicably together. They may be written or unwritten, and they give expression not just to the ways of government in terms of structures and procedures, but the values that a community thinks should underpin them. And so there's a similar definition of thinking about a constitution that's in the New Zealand Cabinet Manual. It talks about a constitution is about public power, and the power of the state. It describes and establishes the major institutions of government, states their principal powers, and regulates the exercise of those powers in a broad way. While all constitutions have these general characteristics, each constitution is affected by the national character of the state that it serves. And I think important in both of those ideas is the sense that constitutions, while they take a legal form, and there may be legal mechanisms that help to enforce them, that they're ultimately underpinned by the people, by the legitimacy that comes from accepting or determining that this is the way in which decisions should be made, the kinds of people who ought to be involved in decision-making, the kinds of processes which should be undertaken. And one of the things that I also think is important to note from the New Zealand Cabinet Manual is that when it talks about the New Zealand Constitution, it mentions that it can be found in a whole range of different sources. So we know there are some parts of it that might be written down, like Te Tiriti o Waitangi. There might be some pieces of legislation that are important for our Constitution, things like the Bill of Rights Act or the Constitution Act. But there are also decisions from the courts which inform our constitutional practice, and there are also what we talk about as constitutional conventions, so things which are not written down but are accepted by constitutional actors, by the people involved, as being an obligation on them or limits on their powers. And the New Zealand Cabinet Manual explicitly refers to the fact that Te Tiriti o Waitangi is increasingly reflected or regarded as a founding document of the government of New Zealand. Now, as I mentioned, the panel from Te Papa, the actions of Te Waka Haurua, and the redaction that took place, I think was a really effective mechanism in terms of focusing our attention on how Te Tiriti is presented to us, how we might understand it collectively, and how we might give more accurate, better meaning to it collectively as well. I'm going to come back to Te Papa in a moment, but one of the things I thought I might be helpful to do in this conversation today is to set out a little bit about some of the ways in which the constitutional importance of Te Tiriti has changed over time, the constitutional importance that society has given to it, I should say. Of course, the terms of Te Tiriti haven't changed. The agreement itself hasn't changed, but the ways in which it's been recognised by government, by the courts, and by society has changed over time. And I think there are some important markers of that change. Because I think if we go back to 1877 and the now probably infamous decision in Wee Parata and the Bishop of Wellington, this is a case, I don't need to go into the details of this case here, but it's a case that all law students come to know, and many others know as well, for the statement in the judgment that te tiriti was a simple nullity. That is, that it's certainly its legal, constitutional meaning was nothing. It had no effect according to the court. The court noted that, sure, it might impose some moral obligations. The Crown might feel compelled morally to fulfill promises that it's entered into. But these were not of a nature that the court could enforce. They weren't legal obligations. And the reasoning for this is the discredited reasoning, I should say, is that the judge took the view that Māori were not capable of exercising sovereignty in 1841. And so therefore a document that purported to transfer some authority to the British Crown was a simple nullity, was legally meaningless. Now, some aspects of that decision were challenged almost immediately, and over the next 100 years or so, aspects of it were chipped away. But it wasn't really until the early 21st century that decision was fully overturned. And so from 1877 onwards, we had set in place a legal and constitutional story which said the treaty is meaningless. And one of the things about the common law is that it has a tendency to present itself as though its outcomes or the decisions of the courts are inevitable, that there's only one outcome that can be arrived at, and that it simply waiting to be declared as law if you follow the proper legal logic. Now, we know that that's not the case, and I hope that most lawyers would accept that that's not the case. And then, in fact, in most instances, even following legal process, precedents and logic and analysis, that there may be different alternatives or different pathways that could be followed, different choices to be made. And certainly when we look at the story of te tiriti and thinking about the way in which it has been recognised or not over the course of the last 186 years, we can see that there were always different choices available. There were always other stories that could have been told and alternative paths that could have been taken to imbuing te tiriti with a fuller constitutional meaning. And we can even see that in some of the actions that the colonial government was taking shortly after the signing of te tiriti. One of the examples that people often point to is the Constitution Act of 1852 and Section 71 of that Act, which provides for the establishment of districts where Māori law would operate. I'll give you the language of the Act here, which is legalistic and a bit old-timey, but it says, Section 71 says, is entitled Provisions as to Māori Law and Customs. It says, and whereas it may be expedient that the laws, customs and usages of the Aboriginal or native Māori inhabitants of New Zealand, so far as they are not repugnant to the general principles of humanity, should for the present be maintained for the government of themselves in all relations to and dealings with each other, and that particular districts should be set apart within which such laws, customs, or usages should be so observed. Now, no such districts were ever established, but that provision in the Constitution Act in 1852 demonstrates that even a colonial government that was assuming sovereignty for itself was recognizing the ability to carve out some areas whereby Maori authority would operate, albeit within limited geographic boundaries. And so we see, when we look at the way in which Te Tiriti has been interpreted and applied, that at different points in our history, it has been given better recognition, or that at least there were options to provide for a fuller constitutional recognition than the story in the Wee Parata case would tell us, that story which said that Te Tiriti was a simple nullity. Now, the exhibition Signs of a Nation, that Te Papa, of course, plays a really important role in the public understanding of the meaning of Te Tiriti. And I think, again, we can reflect on some of the choices that were made in terms of how that exhibition was presented. And initially, and this was part of the motivation, of course, for Te Waka Haurua's action, but initially the exhibition was presented with the English text on a panel on one wall, facing it the Te Reo Māori text on the other wall, and an image of the document of Te Tiriti sitting between them. Now, thinking back to when Te Papa opened in 1998, I think it was, and the decision then about how to present this important constitutional document for Aotearoa, I can see some of the reasoning behind why that choice was made. I can see, for example, the need in thinking about in public institutions like Te Papa that you always need to make choices around what are the messages that you are communicating, what are the most important messages that need to be communicated through an exhibition. And certainly, I think at that time, one of the most important messages would have been that there was not only an English text, but of course there was a Te Reo Māori text as well. Today, I think we are in a very different position from where we were at the end of the 20th century in terms of thinking about what are the most important messages to convey. And even at the time, of course, there were questions around would establishing that exhibition in that way provide the most accurate reflection of how we ought to understand and give meaning to Te Tiriti. Because, of course, in focusing on the fact that there are two different language texts, it perhaps leads us into the misconception that there are two texts of equivalent value in terms of determining the meaning of Te Tiriti. And one of the things that the actions of Te Waka Haurua have really focused our attention on is the fact that, of course, as is well known, the English text and the Te Reo text do not say exactly the same thing. But more significantly than that is that by presenting them as equally valid texts of a treaty, it suggests that the work that we have to do then is to think about how we reconcile those two different language texts. And actually, I think there are lots of valid reasons for why we would give greater weight to the te reo text, and in fact, why we ought to think of the te reo text as the authoritative treaty instrument. And it doesn't mean that the English text has no meaning. It doesn't mean that the English text isn't helpful for us in understanding the te reo text and the agreement that was reached. But it shifts that work that we need to do from thinking about trying to reconcile to different equivalent texts to ones in which we can think of how, for example, a draft might help us interpret the final operative document. And that's partly why when I talk about te tiriti now, I try to shift that language from thinking about two texts to thinking about te tiriti and the English draft. As I say, that's not to say that the English draft isn't very important in helping us to understand the agreement that was entered into, but it's used as an interpretive aid. Now, some of the reasons why I think we ought to think of te tiriti as the kind of official operative agreement, there are some quite kind of practical reasons for that. The fact that almost everyone who signed the te reo text, signed te tiriti, that even where there were a couple of signings which took place with only the English written text was available, even in those situations, the explanation and discussion which took place about the meaning of te tiriti all took place in te reo Māori. And so those terms that appear in te tiriti, the concepts of kāwanatanga and tino rangatiratanga, that was the language that was used to discuss that treaty instrument and its meaning, even though the English text might have been what was available to sign. So I think there's some kind of good practical reasons. There's also some legal reasons in terms of, in particular, thinking about international law principles for treaty interpretation. And there is one doctrine which applies here, which the Latin term is contra proferentum, and it means against the offerer. So essentially the principle is that where you have a treaty which has been interpreted or translated into more than one language, if there is any dispute or ambiguity between the different languages, then weight ought to be given to the text that was not in the language of the drafter. Now, that might sound a bit convoluted, but the way that I like to explain this, or the way in which I find helpful to think about this, is in thinking about if you have a piece of cake that you want to share between two people, you might use the kind of time-honored practice of saying, well, you cut and I'll choose. Okay, and the principle of that works pretty well. It's the idea that the person who's making the cut wants to make it as even as possible so that they don't get left with a much smaller slice of the cake, but that they will bear the burden if they do make an uneven cut. And that's essentially the principle of contra proferentum in international law, is that if you have drafted a treaty and you are responsible for the translation, then if there's any ambiguity between the texts, then you ought to bear the burden for that. You ought to take on the cost. And so the principle of contra preferentum says that you ought to look then the authoritative version, or weight ought to be given to the text that is not from the drafting party. And in the case of Te Tiriti, it would be, of course, the text in Te Reo. So there are both practical reasons and international law reasons that could apply as well to support the argument for seeing Te Tiriti, the Te Reo text, as the authoritative treaty agreement. Now, the Waitangi Tribunal, interestingly, has also acknowledged that principle and has stated that when it's interpreting Te Tiriti or the principles of the treaty which it's required to give effect to and apply, that it will give weight to the Te Reo text. But the tribunal is also required by its legislation to apply not Te Tiriti itself, but this concept of the principles of the treaty. And I know that this is something that Luke Fitzmaurice Brown is going to pick up on in his kōrero, talking about that concept of the principles of the treaty and the way that it is not the same as thinking about applying Te Tiriti itself. And so the Waitangi Tribunal was required to look at both the Māori and the English, but even still, it says, for these reasons, for these practical reasons, for these reasons of international law, that greater weight ought to be given to Te Tiriti in Te Reo. And the Waitangi Tribunal, I wanted to mention particularly because that's another kind of marker of the development in which we've seen the constitutional meaning of Te Tiriti change. Because from the decision in Wiparata, where we have this story that tells us that the treaty doesn't mean anything in a legal or constitutional sense, part of the issue that the tribunal, the establishment of the tribunal, is trying to address is that the courts are then unable to engage directly with Te Tiriti, or were under the Wiparata doctrine. And so, after increasing direct action, and I think again reflecting on the work that Te Waka Haurua have done in terms of the importance of direct action and bringing about changes in constitutional meaning and effect, or the public discussion about it at least, after increasing direct action, we see the Waitangi Tribunal established as a body that is able to address claims or issues that are based on Te Tiriti, or as I say, technically based on this concept of the principles of the treaty. The Waitangi Tribunal established in 1975, just over 50 years old now. And when it is first established, that becomes an important marker in terms of Parliament recognising that there ought to be some constitutional mechanism to address issues based on Te Tiriti. And so that's, as I say, a really important marker in the constitutional development, or how we have given meaning, effect and legitimacy to thinking about Te Tiriti within our constitution. So even just the establishment of the tribunal provides that important shift. But also the work that the tribunal has done over the past 50 years, I think its most important work has actually been in the work, or its impact on public understanding and in that public education space. It's hard for many of us to think back to a time before the Waitangi Tribunal, and despite my grey hairs, it's a time before even I was born. But thinking about that time before the tribunal, and I hear people reflecting who were working on treaty issues before 1975, reflecting on the fact that at that time there was no public visibility really of Te Tiriti and what it might mean. There would have been little understanding that there was a Māori text as well as an English text. So even where there was discussion, the discussion took place in public spaces and around the English text. Even if we look back at Sir Apurana Ngata's explanation about Te Tiriti and its meaning, even he was focused on explaining the English text rather than thinking about more broadly its meaning and certainly the impact of some of those important Māori concepts that are contained within Te Tiriti. And so the work that the tribunal has done over 50 years has really shifted public understanding about Te Tiriti and about New Zealand history and about the role that Te Tiriti might play in law and government and policy. The other aspect that I wanted to mention, connected to the tribunal, but also I think helping to change our story about the meaning, or constitutional meaning, I should say, of Te Tiriti, is this phase of treaty settlements that we have been working through and continue to work through. Now, I have a lot of issues with the treaty settlement process, and I think there are some quite fundamental flaws in the process itself. But there has undoubtedly been important work done through the establishment of those settlements, through reaching those settlement agreements, that again have shifted public understanding about our past and about the role that Te Tiriti might play in helping to redress some of those issues. All treaty settlements have an agreed historical account in them, which provides an opportunity to explicitly shift the historical narrative, particularly in a local area, about the relationship between Māori and the Crown and the role that Te Tiriti has there. There have been significant settlements which have taken quite innovative steps to recognise the legal personality of landscape features, so Te Uruwera, formerly a national park, Te Awa Tupua, formerly the Whanganui River, and Taranaki Maunga, now all have slightly different mechanisms which recognise that that forest, that river, that those mountains have their own legal personality. And importantly, that doesn't just have an impact on the way in which, for example, Tūhoe might engage with Te Uruwera, but it requires all of us actually to reconceptualise what our relationship is with that space or that river or that mountain. And so I think those settlements and some of the more creative and innovative aspects of them are also helping to shift the way in which we tell the story about the impact of Te Tiriti, or how it might underpin the way in which we make decisions, who might be involved in those decisions, what might be the constraints on government power in some of those spaces. So those are really just a few kind of broad outlines of the landscape and the way in which I think we can see our constitutional understanding of Te Tiriti changing in the way in which we might give meaning to it in that constitutional and legal space shifting. You're going to hear more if you come to the other lunchtime talks. As I say, from Luke, we'll talk more about that concept of treaty principles and how that's been applied and misused, and particularly around some of the more recent actions of this government. Peter Adds is going to talk to you more about some of the history and the creation of the founding constitutional documents in this space. And I know Julia Faiporti is going to be talking with you more about what that might mean in the context of thinking about Indigenous rights and human rights more broadly, and the relationship between Te Tiriti and those some international instruments, but as well as thinking about what it means in the context of a particular agency, the Human Rights Commission. So, as I say, I've maintained the role of the first speaker and leaving those conversations for them to pick up with you, but just setting out a few markers around the landscape between 1840 and today that provide a bit of background and context to some of the things that they'll talk further with you about. And really all I wanted to come back to finish on was to acknowledge all the work in this space, but particularly the action undertaken by Te Waka Haurua, which really has encouraged us, reminded us to refocus on the text of Te Tiriti and to understand the promises that were made, the relationship that it established, and the rights and obligations that adhere within that relationship. Kia ora koutou.